Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
Hello, Happy News listeners. My name is Anatoly. I'm happy to bring you happy news from Uganda.
I'm Kerry with some happy news of heroics in Taiwan.
Hi, I'm Brett, and I've got some good news about the Great Barrier Reef.
This is the Happy Pod from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in this edition, uploaded on Saturday, July the 15th, the revolutionary incubator saving babies' lives in war zones and beyond.
When you get pictures back from the field of a child that's actually been impacted by something you've done, it's special. It's something no one can take away from you.
The man who has deduced that humans have been kissing a lot longer than we once thought. African warning drums and modern technology, the inspiration that led to an award-winning invention.
Really making sure that your impact is felt while you live on this planet is really coming to reality, and that gives us so much joy.
Also, what happens when artists from 90 countries meet in Norway?
The idea that you're not alone. So I think that was like what I learned, that we all long for that, we all want that.
And we begin with a solution to a life or death problem. Around the world, one in every 10 babies is born prematurely. They are incredibly vulnerable. But most can be saved with appropriate interventions, including the warmth of an incubator. James Roberts was a student when he came up with his incubator, inspired by a documentary about Syria. Its special design makes it possible to use in otherwise impossible situations, and it's now in service in Ukraine, where it's played its part in saving well over 1,000 babies. His MOM incubator was recognised this week by the Royal Academy of Engineering, and he explained what makes his design different from the traditional model.
They're massive, huge pieces of kit, take up a lot of space. They're very heavy, complicated pieces of equipment. What we've done is taken the same type of therapy and put it into a much more flexible solution, meaning that we can go anywhere around the hospital, you can fold up into a small space. You can really take it anywhere and deliver the system anywhere that needs to be. We really focused on the user and try to make a device that was seamless, something that was simple to use. The problem with simplicity is I think sometimes people think basic and anything's further from the truth. Designing in simplicity is an incredibly hard thing to do, meaning that we can have almost one button operation on the front means that we have to do a lot of the clever stuff underneath the system. If you think about what a clinician has to do every day, you think about the amount of devices they have to interact with just to effectively save lives, and then look at the complications when you first see them. I don't know if you're anything like me, but I get confused when I go to a friend's house, they've got a different TV remote than I do. We've made it as easy as possible for a clinician to use so they can have a trusted bit of equipment that they know is going to work.
When you came up with this, you were 22 and still at university. Why were you drawn to this?
So I'm a product designer, or design engineer, I guess, by background. Went to study at Loughborough University. Design was my first love. In the final year of study, we get given the brief of design something that solves a problem. I sat down in front of the TV and a documentary came on basically saying that because they lacked what they thought was a simple piece of medical equipment, they're effectively losing entire generations. So I decided to try and come up with a system that solved those problems. I then told my parents what I was doing. And my mum then said, which I didn't know about, that she was born preterm in the 1960s and was probably one of the first incubators in the UK. And without one, I wouldn't be here.
So you've created this thing and it's already saving lives in places where it's desperately needed. Tell us about some of the places where it's being deployed.
The most notable ones is that there's quite a few of these in Ukraine at the moment. We were getting reports that they're having to take babies down to the bunkers where they were getting cold and at risk of passing away, or the nurses were having to stay up in the maternity centres at risk of being maimed. So they're having to make those really tough calls. With our device, they don't need to do that. They could create makeshift neonatal intensive care units in these shelters. We're also being used in the NHS at the moment. It's all focused around keeping mother and father closer to the child in these really stressful times.
Your achievement is being celebrated internationally. You've been recognised with the Royal Academy of Engineering's Princess Royal Silver Medal. It's lovely to get the recognition, isn't it? But that's really not what it's about.
The recognition is amazing. Don't get me wrong. It's a really heartwarming accolade to have, and I'm hugely appreciative of it. But in terms of what excites us the most, or what gets us up in the morning to come to work every day, it is when you get pictures back from the field of a child that's actually been impacted by something you've done. It's special. It's something no one can take away from you.
Do you have ambitions to branch out into something else? What's next for you?
Mum's vision is to give every child access to smarter healthcare technology. That is a broad vision. The incubator is our flag in the ground. It shows this is what we've done. We've done something that I think very difficult to do, but shows we can do it with other products and other things going in the future, whether that be in a hospital context or even in the home. If we're trusted to look after the most vulnerable children or the most vulnerable patients, literally newborn babies, then why wouldn't we be trusted elsewhere as well by the parents who see what we've done?
That was James Roberts, CEO and founder of Mom Incubators. Now let's talk about kissing. It appears that for some time, our assumptions about humanity's earliest record of romantic kissing was about 1,000 years out. Scientists have been joining the dots on the evidence, and it seems that humans actually began puckering up, about 4,500 years ago in some of the earliest Mesopotamian societies. Dr. Truls Pank Arbul co-authored the report. He is an expert on the history of medicine in Mesopotamia at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. And he told us how the study came about.
My co-author, Sophie Lund Rasmussen, who's also incidentally my wife, and I were discussing an article that came out last year that had to do with herpes simplex virus.
The herpes simplex virus, the cold sore virus. Well, that's romantic.
Oh, yeah. And that's what we do over dinner at night. So it's always nice. But we were discussing this article. She's a biologist. I'm an astrologist. So we were discussing this article, and it had been proposed in that maybe this virus had evolved due to the introduction of kissing in Europe at some point many thousand years ago. And we were a bit puzzled by that, and we thought it sounded interesting, started reading up on what the background was. And one of the things I quickly realized was that all the literature that had to do with the origin of the kiss actually described it as originating in India, and the earliest reference as being from 1500 BCE. And I knew in my field that we had older sources. So I started reading up on it, and I quickly realized that the earliest reference we had to kissing was from 2500 BCE. We set out to try and describe this and look at some of the anthropological literature that had to do with the context wherein kissing occurs and so on.
So you've already raised the cold sore thing. It's clearly not all about romance. How much of the research, how much of the evidence basically boils down to the spread of disease?
Well, we also looked into what might be said in favor or not in favor of kissing as a means of disease transmission. And obviously, it has been involved. It can't be avoided when you exchange saliva like that. But it's clear that it must have been relatively widespread in the ancient world. And it seems to have had several points of origins. And that's probably why we see it in several groups of historical sources. It has been proposed previously that, well, it originated in India and spread from there. But I think we can safely put that debate to rest now. And of course, there might have been communities that didn't practice this sexual romantic kissing. In anthropology, at least, there is this hypothesis in relation to modern day cultures all over the world that it's actually not the majority that practices sexual romantic kissing. It's only somewhere in the 40% that practices it. And the thing that anthropology has suggested is that in modern day, the societies that practice sexual romantic kissing are also socially complex or have a lot of different social classes.
But it's interesting you talk about different classes and complicated social strata. It's not just humans that do it, is it?
No, exactly. Our closest living relatives, for example, chimpanzees and bonobos, tend to engage in these acts of kissing in relation to social relations and sexual interactions as well. So there is definitely a behavior that might be found, I would assume, quite far back in the Homo sapiens as well.
Dr. Troels Pank Arbol. Now, this one doesn't start very positively, but stay with me, it gets better. It begins with a man following and attacking a woman on a street in the Taiwanese city of Taitung. A man has been arrested and charged. The woman is said to be recovering well in hospital. The good part is the intervention of three men who came to her aid. Kerry Allen, our China media analyst, has been following the story.
Obviously a horrific incident, but what happened within a very short space of time is a man driving by suddenly turned his car around and him and his two sons jumped out the car and just grabbed improvised weapons and basically tried to get this man to drop his knife.
And when you say improvised weapons?
When I say improvised weapons, I mean a soup ladle, a fan, and a suitcase. And these amazing pictures have circulated all over Taiwanese media. And you see the man with the ladle literally managed to whack it out of his hand.
And the video was extraordinary. I wondered if it was real. Has it been verified?
It has been verified. It's been all over Taiwanese media. Outlets have been speaking to witnesses. Taiwanese media spoke to one woman who works at a local nut stand.
Those two university students suppressed him. He was brandishing a knife, a really long utility knife. Then one of the students said to me, "We've got the knife, call the police." He then came and grabbed my electric fan to hit him with.
So what do we know about the men who came to the rescue?
Well, we know that they're a man and his two sons. The father is being named as Xu Shiguang. And yeah, they just happened to be driving by.
The suspect attacked the victim and we immediately turned the car around. We quickly got out and confronted him. I looked for something by the road that I could use. It just happened to be a soup ladle. I grabbed it.
And what sort of reaction has there been?
Oh, there's been huge reaction to this. I mean, what an incredible story. And the footage and images that have been shared are just incredible. I mean, it looks like something out of a video game, just these men surrounding this one man with such unconventional, such weird weapons. And yeah, it's a scene that you don't see very often.
That was Kerry Allen and bravo, Xu Shiguang and Sons. Still to come in this podcast.
So I thought, hey, we can start looking at using the same process as the reef uses to glue everything together, but accelerate it by using this bioglue.
The new process that could help the Great Barrier Reef recover.
Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast bringing you the best of African football. I'm former Congolese captain Gabriel Zakwani, and joining me for hosting duties, Ivory Coast's Yaya Toure.
Hi, Yaya Toure here. Yeah.
And Nigeria's Efan Okoku.
Hi.
Each week, we're trying to decide who makes it to number one on our African football top 10 lists. That's Match of the Day Africa Top 10 from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
When your business travel is out of balance, you feel it. At National Car Rental, you're in control. Skip the counter, choose any car in the aisle, and manage your rental right from the app, so you can balance the boardroom with the not-so-board. Climb rocks after you rock your presentation, and mix work with leisure, or leisure with work. Find the perfect balance with National Car Rental. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.
Take on a mission to unlock the real magic of that great Coca-Cola taste, updated with a twist. New limited edition flavor Coca-Cola Ultimate has been co-created with League of Legends. Taste the plus XP and level up by serving it ice cold for maximum refreshment. Scan the QR code on the bottle for unique digital and IRL experiences. League of Legends. Coca-Cola. Try new Ultimate limited edition flavor.
Now to one of your sounds. This one sent by John Holloway, whose location is, well, wherever his boat is. Bagpipes, but not any old pipes. What's special about this sound, John?
Galician pipes only have one or two drones instead of the Scottish pipes, which have three. So the melodies are much lighter and they're the sort of thing which bring a smile to your face and you can't help wanting to start to dance, which is a completely different experience from listening to the Scottish pipes, which tend to be much more serious or sometimes even funereal.
Steady on, John. I actually had bagpipes at my wedding, but thanks.
I discovered them about 15 years ago. I'd gone along the north coast of Spain and arrived in this little tiny village, and they have the World Celtic Music Festival there every year, and about 100,000 people turn up for this festival in this little village. So every little bit of grass has got a tent on it. Every granny is looking after somebody's children. And that's where I discovered it, this amazing sound. So whenever I hear the pipes, I have these very vivid memories of the girls going down the streets behind the pipers with their tambourines. And it's the memories of having a lovely glass of Galician beer in a bar with people. On the night of the full moon, we have a bring and share supper. And we spend the whole evening laughing and joking and eating whatever everybody's brought along.
And the international festival of which John speaks is wrapping up this weekend in Galicia. So we missed this year, but we are shamelessly angling for an invitation to next year's festival if anyone who can make that happen is listening. Now, some of the other stories that caught our eye over the last few days. A zoo in South Korea is celebrating the birth of its first giant panda twins. The twins, both female, were born at the Everland theme park near the capital Seoul. It's fair to say that the Ukrainian tennis player Elena Svitolina didn't expect to do as well as she did at Wimbledon this year. She had bought tickets to see a Harry Styles concert in Vienna, but had to give them away in order to concentrate on her day job. The good news for her is that Harry saw her Instagram post and offered her tickets for any of his remaining shows. Another animal story, if I sneak it in quickly, no one will mind. 14 of Angola's native giraffes have been transported to their homeland decades after becoming extinct in the wild there. The Giraffe Conservation Foundation says that recent efforts to protect giraffes have seen their population start to rebound after 35 years of decline. Also, some promising news this week on dealing with the varroa mite, the deadly parasite that has devastated honeybee populations around the world. It turns out that the tiny mite can be identified by a distinctive walk, and that could lead to the development of a remote detection system allowing beekeepers to eradicate infestations early. Now, time for some clever innovation. And a software engineer in Uganda has come up with a way of improving neighbourhood security with a modern take on a traditional practice. For centuries, people across Uganda, Kenya, Nigeria and Tanzania have used drums to alert their community to an emergency. Anatoly Kirigwajo took that idea and, using modern tech, came up with a device that, at the touch of a button, connects neighbours and the police, alerting them all to an attack or robbery and hopefully prompting a swift community response. The Younger device has won Anatoly this year's Africa Prize, the continent's largest engineering award, announced at a ceremony in Accra, Ghana. And he told us more.
My inspiration draws very long ago when I just finished school. And then I get a phone call when my neighbor tells me, your house is open and there's nothing in the house. And then because I had done computer science, I was an engineer, software engineering, I asked myself what I could do over time.
So you were robbed yourself. Some inspiration as well, I gather, from African warning drums.
Yeah, so I remembered that our elders told a story of how in the villages they would be put into clusters of homes, and then the government of that time would equip them with drums as tools. So once you would get robbed, maybe you would drum twice. And then if you had a sick person at home, you'd now maybe drum once. And they knew which kind of tone that would actually call for a specific kind of action.
What have your family and friends had to say?
Wow, my family and friends have been really very good fan of us from day one, and they are super, super excited. And the beauty of it is that some of them have been already onboarded on the Younger system. And all this really means that our family members and friends are very proud and excited of the new invention that we are bringing to help people in Africa that are very prone to this kind of crime.
What does the Africa Prize mean to you?
I'm very, very super excited because the legacy that we've always been talking about, creating a dent in the universe and really making sure that your impact is felt while you live on this planet, is really coming to reality. And that gives us so much joy.
Anatoly Kiragwajo from Uganda. And we'll hear from his co-winner, Edmund Vessels from South Africa, in next week's edition. Now, more from you. Mohammed from Iran says he loves it when his 7-year-old African grey parrot, Behrang, says hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
And if any of you can train your parrots to say, "This is the Happy Pod," we would be thrilled. And this was shared by Kevin in Oakville, Ontario. And he says that is the sound of his Welsh terrier's tags jiggling as he goes for his morning walk. Now, when we break things, we might be tempted to try and stick them back together. And even though it's a little bit more complicated than that, scientists working to repair Australia's Great Barrier Reef are sort of doing just that. The coral reefs are being badly damaged by cyclones and boats, and they need patching up so that they can regrow and recover. Enter Brett Lewis from Queensland University of Technology and his biodegradable putty.
At our core level, we want to regrow corals and we want to hope that corals can maintain themselves during climate change. But for corals to continue to regrow, you need a substrate and a stable one that they can grow onto. And so there have been some attempts to kind of stabilize it, and some are kind of successful, but they're very intrusive. Some require large amounts of metal frames to be put out on the reef. So in pretty much most cases, we're intruding in the environment. Our intervention is very obvious. And if it fails, we leave behind rubbish. So I saw this adhesive, this bioadhesive, something that can be produced from waste from sawmills and plants. It's easily attainable. It's easily made. It's very cheap. And as long as we produce it correctly, it's non-harmful to the environment. So I thought, hey, this could be an application for them. Using the same process as the reef uses to glue everything together, but accelerate it by using this bio glue.
So tell us about the point at which you realized, actually, this could be the answer. This could work. Was there a eureka moment? Do scientists still say eureka?
Not this one. It's a very slow and arduous process. The truth is these adhesives have been worked on for decades. So we are just building on that work, and it has taken a long time to get us here. And we'll continue to refine the adhesive and maybe even make better ones in the future that work even better than the current one.
And of course, the Great Barrier Reef is vast. It's huge. How will you be deploying this putty? Tell us about how that will happen.
One part of how we're trying to understand the Great Barrier Reef is to identify areas of threat. So we're doing a vast amount of mapping to try and work out and target these areas and help those areas out. And then when we go to do that, we will be using automation. So here at QUT, we have a school that is really focused on robotics. And speaking with them so far, the idea here is to deploy a fleet of robots that will be able to go out and inject these adhesives into these targeted areas that we've already mapped out.
The last time I was on the Great Barrier Reef was at the end of the last century. It was very lovely. We talk about it as, you know, it's a great natural wonder of the world. For people who haven't seen it, describe the Great Barrier Reef.
I'll put it this way. When I first started out and I decided that I was going to travel Australia, I was going to do everywhere. The moment I got to the Great Barrier Reef, I never left. I stayed there for 3 years, and I decided after those 3 years that I was going to do a degree in science and try and help protect it. So I don't know how to put its beauty in words, but it is very much inspiring when you go there.
What's your hope for the reef and for your work on the reef?
So my personal goal is to make sure that there are coral reefs available and still alive by 2050 in order for them to hopefully recover when we have got everything under control.
That was Brett Lewis of Queensland University of Technology. Artists from 90 countries, from Iran to Italy, Belgium to Brazil and Costa Rica to Canada, have converged on a small Norwegian island best known as the home of Edvard Munch. Jeløy is 50 kilometres from Norway's capital, Oslo, close to the coastal town of Moss. And for the next few months, it's hosting the Nordic Biennale of Contemporary Art with the theme Gathering Together. Our reporter, Iona Hampson, travelled to Jeløy to hear from the artists.
Oslo-based art collective Ten House have invited artists from around the world to take part in this year's Momentum Biennale at Gallery F15 on the water's edge of the Oslo Fjord. From immersive spaces and sculptures to short documentaries, the contemporary pieces are so different from the work of the famous Norwegian painter Edvard Munch, best known for his work The Scream, who used to live on a farm nearby.
I'm Dag Åge Sveinar. I'm the director of Gallery F15. The position of the sun is changing all year around. For Edvard Munch, it was very nice because he got more and more interested in colors. So he liked to live here and to stroll around and just to get inspired.
Together as together is a slogan the artists are engaging with and leads to an experience for all the senses.
In this period building, I come to this doorway, which has planks of wood nailed to the side. And I'm just going to come under the sheets, this tie-dye sheet, to this room, which really smells of seaweed, which covers the floor. Wet, which is this female collective of graffiti artists who've gone around Europe to create their graffiti. What they want to depict is their challenging journey in which, as female graffiti artists, they feel that they're not accepted within the community. I actually managed to speak to one of the graffiti artists who did not want to be named, and I found out a little bit more about their journey.
It's a lot of waiting, yeah, and like a lot of stress, and I don't know if I want to expose the secret.
For some artists, the invitation to be part of something so diverse allows for a safe personal expression.
My name is Nayara Leite. I'm an artist from Brazil. And the video tells about also my coming out story as a bit of a link to the rainbow flags. And so I show my first rainbow flag as well here.
My name is Geisha. I'm from Good School, from Indonesia. To go here, we need to apply for visa. It's a long process, complicated process. And now we're here, we can be able to tell these stories. We are able to meet these lovely people. So it's a gratitude.
So what can we learn from creatives coming together from around the world?
The idea that you're not alone. So I think that was like what I learned, that we all long for that, we all want that, you know, that you're not alone. You have these people that maybe doesn't speak the same language with you, but you still like feel that their presence, and then can connect beyond languages, beyond boundaries, and then have something they can have once they return to their home.
That report from Norway was by Iona Hampson. And that's it from us for now. But remember, if you would like to participate, you can send the sound that brings you joy, or indeed anything else you want to contribute to, really, to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes-Porter. The producers were Anna Murphy and Phoebe Hobson. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.